For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We'll talk with Andrew Seidel about what's wrong with healthcare sharing ministries.
Then we'll interview Bart Warden, Executive Director of the American Ethical Union,
about how to be good without God.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. On the fourth day of the COP26 summit in Glasgow, the UN Environment Agency has urged countries to spend much more on adaptation measures so that they can withstand damage and limit destruction from climate shocks. Leading the appeal from the UN Environment Programme, Executive Director Inge Andersen said that as the world looks to step up efforts to cut greenhouse gas emissions, which still aren't strong enough, it must also dramatically up its game to adapt to climate change. Impacts such as wildfires, droughts and flooding will be with us for decades to come, she noted. According to a new UNEP report, adaptation costs are likely to reach close to $300 billion a year by the end of the decade. The UN agency also said that countries are not using COVID-19 recovery investment to support projects to withstand climate emergencies, since only a small portion of the $16.7 trillion stimulus measures has been spent on adaptation. To Afghanistan now, and a stark warning from the UN Migration Agency, IOM, which said on Thursday that ongoing conflict, grinding poverty and climate-related emergencies have pushed the country to the brink of collapse. People are broke and broken, said IOM Director General Antonio Vitorino after returning from a two-day visit to the country. He said that more than half the population is struggling to eat, malnutrition is reaching dramatic levels, especially for many children, and over more than 8 in 10 people contacted by the agency had lost their jobs and livelihoods. Millions are now living in inadequate shelters with limited access to basic services, including sanitation and healthcare, Mr. Vitorino said, adding that 5.5 million people are now internally displaced inside Afghanistan. This includes more than 670,000 who've been forced to leave their homes this year, 60% of whom are children. Staying with Afghanistan, UN Children's Fund UNICEF said that 9 members of one family have died after an explosive remnant of war detonated inside a home in the northern city of Kunduz. The victims included 4 girls and 2 boys, while 3 other children were injured in the blast, the UN agency said on Thursday. Reportedly, one of the children unknowingly brought the unexploded device into the home after finding it in the field next to their house, possibly to play with or in the hope of selling it, said Alice Akunga, UNICEF acting representative in Afghanistan. She said that the incident underlined the urgent need to clear explosive ordnance and sensitize communities to the risks. More than 460 children were killed because of the conflict in Afghanistan in the first 6 months of the year before the Taliban takeover on the 15th of August, according to UNICEF. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Welcome to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and this is our first show of November 2021.
And actually, it was your birthday this week, too, so happy birthday,
Annie Laurie.
I'm Dan Barker, co-host of Free Thought Radio. This is the November 4th, 2021 edition of Free Thought Radio. Our engineer is Grant Blaschka. He's in the Stephen Ewell Friendly Atheist Studio in Free Thought Hall. Free Thought Hall is the national office of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is in Madison, Wisconsin.
The Freedom From Religion Foundation is the producer of the weekly Free Thought Radio, and FFRF is a group that works so that reason, science, and the godless constitution of the United States of America prevail. rather than having a theocracy, basically. And our members, 35,000 plus, are non-religious themselves, and we work to keep religion out of government as our secular constitution dictates. If you are an FFRF member, thank you so much. If you're not, we'd love to send you information. We have a newspaper and a brochure about our 40-plus years of activism. You can ask for information at FFRF.org, or you can just join us there.
FFRF members are non-religious, meaning mostly atheists and agnostics and secular humanists. But we're going to ask a question on today's show. Can you be a religious person and not believe in God? Our guest in the second half of today's show says you can. Bart Warden is the executive director of the American Ethical Union, which was founded in 1876 as a non-theistic, humanistic, religious fellowship.
And before that, in a few minutes, FFRF's Director of Strategic Response, Andrew Seidel, will join us to talk about the letter that the Congressional Freethought Caucus has sent the Bureau of Consumer Protection warning about something called healthcare sharing ministries. These are deceptive religious systems, not actually insurance companies, that fail to provide adequate health care for more than a million Americans who put their trust in their religious community rather than the regulated health care system. So we'll be chewing over that with Andrew in a few minutes.
And we're talking about abortion this week. We have a weekly TV show. It's called Ask an Atheist.
Well, it's a video show.
Yeah, well, it's TV. You can watch it on your laptop or whatever. Or you can watch it on your TV. It's on Facebook Live. And what's the topic this week, Annie Laurie?
This week on Ask an Atheist, I interview FFRF attorney Liz Cavell and FFRF's reproductive rights intern Barbara Alvarez about abortion and the Supreme Court. And specifically, Liz dissects the November 1st oral arguments on the Texas abortion ban, and she wrote, with the help of Barbara Alvarez, the amicus brief on the upcoming case that's being heard in December on the Mississippi abortion ban. So Liz pointed to the legal difficulty of deciding where to draw a line if you rely on faith rather than science in abortion care.
So our brief is meant to point out that because the court is going to toss out the viability line and say something like, that's nowhere in the Constitution, so we'll just do these on a case-by-case basis, or something like that. And we argued, you know, what are you going to replace this with? Because viability is a workable, evidence-based tool for analysis, and everything else invites religious debate.
And Barbara emphasized that abortion is a human right.
Then I just think that it's especially important to note that the United Nations considers abortion a human right and that denying access is discrimination and can constitute gender-based violence, torture, or cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment. So this is a really important issue for human rights. Abortion is a human right.
And FFRF agreed with the Solicitor General Elizabeth Prelogar, who concluded Monday's oral arguments very powerfully by noting that no constitutional right is safe if Texas's abortion law stands.
Texas's position is that no one can sue, not the women whose rights are most directly affected, not the providers who have been chilled in being able to provide those women with care, and not the United States in this suit. They say that federal courts just have no authority under existing law to provide any mechanism to redress that harm. And if that is true, if a state can just take this simple mechanism of taking its enforcement authority and giving it to the general public backed up with a bounty of $10,000 or $1 million, if they can do that, then no constitutional right is safe. No constitutional decision from this court is safe. That would be an intolerable state of affairs, and it cannot be the law. Our constitutional guarantees cannot be that fragile, and the supremacy of federal law cannot be that easily subject to manipulation. So we would ask this court to hold that the United States can proceed with this action and affirm the preliminary injunction entered by the district court and immediately vacate the stay that the Fifth Circuit entered in this case so that Texas cannot continue to deny women in its borders a right protected by this court's precedents one day longer.
Wow, that was very powerful, wasn't it? You can watch that entire Ask an Atheist show on FFRF's YouTube channel by looking for the Ask an Atheist playlist. You can also tune in to the live show next week at 12 noon Central on FFRF's Facebook page, where you can ask questions during the show. We also produce a TV show, a real TV talk show, which is broadcast on Sundays. It's called Free Thought Matters. Our guest this week on Free Thought Matters is Manel Salido. He's the president of the Humanists of Spain. Manel is the host of the popular Spanish language show Razón o Fe, which means reason or faith.
Manel spoke to us from near Valencia and told us that Spain has a higher percentage of atheists than the United States.
In Spain, we are very lucky now because a year and a half ago, just before the pandemics, we had 29% of atheists and non-believers.
Wow.
And now we have 39% in just a year and a half. I guess that the pandemics have had something to do with that.
Wow.
I don't think it's a coincidence. So we are running ahead of you. You must shape up.
So
yes,
maybe
we must shape up. I agree.
Yeah, we do need to try to catch up to Spain and the rest of Europe. You can watch that show, that Free Thought Matters episode with Manel Salido, right now on the Free Thought Matters playlist on FFRF's YouTube channel.
Yeah, we drop the new episodes every Thursday. And you can also watch it on broadcast TV. We're trying to reach the unmasked masses in Chicago, Denver, Houston, L.A., Madison, Minneapolis, New York, Phoenix, Portland, Sacramento, Seattle, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco. And those are on Sunday morning, except Madison, which is Sunday night. So stations and times can be found at ffrf.org/news.
So in the news, there's a lot of national and some local news. We're celebrating a new poll from the Pew Research Center that shows that Americans now overwhelmingly support the constitutional principle of the separation between state and church.
Yeah, so we see 54%, which is a majority, think the United States should enforce state-church separation. I wish they would join us and help us because that's what we spend our time doing. And a stronger majority, 69%, say the federal government should never adopt an official state religion. And 69% believe the U.S. Constitution was written by humans and reflects their vision, quote, not necessarily God's vision. Even among white Protestant evangelicals and so on, fewer than half say the U.S. should abandon its adherence to the separation of church and state. There was some nuance in there, but we are very pleased about that development. And then we have filed an amicus brief, another one before the U.S. Supreme Court, involving supporting Maine's secular stance against funding religion. And there is a case called Carson versus Macon. The first U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals decided in favor of Maine, but it's been appealed to the Supreme Court. They've accepted it, never a good sign. And it's all about government money flowing to religious schools. They have a constitutional prohibition on that, and that is what's at stake here. So you can read more about that.
We've seen how the voucher program in Milwaukee has been a real failure, with wasting public money on really inept schools, mostly religious schools.
We also have urged members of Congress who recently attended the National Prayer Breakfast to boycott. About 22 senators and representatives co-sponsored the gala held every year in February this year. We're asking them, don't go next year. We are pointing out that it doesn't make them look good, that it is a it has an ecumenical, non-denominational, nonpartisan veneer, but it's been plagued with scandals, Russian spies, Christian nationalists, anti-LGBTQ bigotry, and so forth. And you'll recall Maria Butina, the foreign agent from Russia that was using the event to back channel with American officials, just one scandalous example.
And it's not an official governmental event. It's a private group called The Family, a right-wing, anti-abortion, anti-LGBT rights group.
Anti-really democracy
group.
Yeah,
and a Christian nationalist group is putting this on. No member of Congress has to go to this thing, and we're asking them to boycott it.
And it's also unfortunate that it does sound as if it is an official governmental event. That's very inappropriate. So we've also sent kind of a fun letter to a Texas member of the state house there who has ridiculously asked all the school libraries and in the 850 schools, or I'm sorry, he's asked hundreds of school districts to blacklist as many as 850 books. It's a search and destroy mission. His name is Matt Krause, and he's a very religious public official, and he is a great Bible believer. And so our letter quotes from some maybe less well-known passages of the Bible, pointing out that he's forgotten a book that really should be on his list.
What he says is, we want to ban books that might make students feel discomfort, guilt, anguish, or any other form of psychological distress because of their race or sex. So all of that is actually in the Bible, our letter points out.
And we quote from the Bible in a way that I don't think we really want to put it over the air. We're, you know, talking about genitals and emission and fondling breasts, and also, you know, talking about killing 200 men and bringing back their foreskins as a dowry, and a sordid, defamatory incest story about girls supposedly, you know, enticing their father to have sex with them so they can bear him children, and on, things that really are not, that are X-rated.
Well, then, and then calling for the death penalty for homosexuals and things that would cause distress to many students.
And we've, you know, said you are seeking to limit children's growth by discouraging them from reading books other than your favorite so-called holy book, while hypocritically ignoring the Bible's abysmal moral and pedagogical failings. So we've urged him to drop his dangerous crusade at once.
And you can read our letter on our website. You go to the news site and look down for that. Now, in Oklahoma, the governor there is doing something really silly about the birth certificates. Governor Kevin Stitt is urging the Oklahoma State Department of Health to remove their gender-neutral category from their birth certificates. The governor said, I believe that people are created by God to be male or female, period. There's no such thing as non-binary sex. I wholeheartedly condemn the purported OSDH court settlement that was entered into by rogue activists.
And actually, the first person in the country to get a birth, a passport that has X on it is a person who is intersex, so born that way. So science tells this governor, you are very wrong. And now we are very proud to announce that we have awarded this year's entries in our Black, Indigenous, People of Color student essay competition over $22,900 in scholarships that are going to 13 major winners and 11 honorable mentions. We asked them to write a persuasive letter. What would I tell my family or friends about my atheism or non-belief? And these were remarkable, Dan, you'll agree.
There were no bad essays in this one.
So great. Oh. They were, some of them angry, some of them very gentle, very persuasive, and they are in the November issue of Free Thought Today. If you're not getting that already, you can ask for a sample on our website. You don't want to miss these insightful, very poignant letters by the winners of our Students of Color essay competition.
So we have to take a break, and after the break, FFRS Director of Strategic Response, Andrew Seidel, will tell us about healthcare sharing ministries, a deceptive alternative to healthcare insurance. And then after that, talking about ethics, we'll speak with Bart Warden. He's the Executive Director of the American Ethical Union. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
The Hello, this is Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
Speaking freely, thinking freely. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And I'm Dan Barker. Welcome back. Healthcare is a really important issue, especially now during the pandemic. But did you know that many Americans are opting out of the regulated healthcare system, and instead they're signing up for these religious healthcare sharing ministries? What is healthcare sharing ministries, and does it do what it promises?
Joining us to talk about that is FFRF's Director of Strategic Response, Andrew Seidel. And Andrew, welcome back to Free Thought Matters. Free Thought Radio.
Thanks.
Getting mixed
up
here.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, we have so many media here. And so can you tell us what the Congressional Free Thought Caucus has just done, what action they have taken about this healthcare ministry?
Sure. We are thrilled that the Congressional Free Thought Caucus has asked the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection to essentially investigate healthcare sharing ministries and all of the problems that arise out of essentially the marketing practices and the failure of healthcare sharing ministries to actually help a lot of people.
Well, what is healthcare sharing ministries?
It sort of packages itself as though it were health insurance. It tends to be significantly cheaper, but they're not health insurance. Essentially, it's a nonprofit of people who all chip in and promise to cover each other's medical costs. And they do this from a religious perspective. That's one of the reasons that it's considered to satisfy the requirements of the ACA. It is pretty insidious because there's no rules or regulations governing it. They can cover procedures or not, essentially at their whims. And John Oliver on Last Week Tonight actually did a fantastic expose on healthcare sharing ministries. If people really want to know some of the fun ins and awful outs of these, they can go watch that.
So, Andrew, you mentioned the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. So Congress made some sort of an exception for, is that right, for healthcare sharing ministries when it passed ACA?
Essentially, yes. And so that exception is now driving more and more people into healthcare sharing ministries because it is cheaper, because it doesn't do the same kind of thing. Right, the coverage is completely inadequate compared to a real insurance plan. For instance, a healthcare sharing ministry doesn't cover things like prescription drugs or mental health or preventative services or vaccinations in a lot of cases, or even maternal health care.
Biggie, Andrew. How can you have this quote unquote insurance that doesn't cover maternal health care? Why wouldn't Christians want?
Not insurance.
Yeah, why wouldn't Christians want a pregnant woman to have good health care?
I think that's one of the central questions of Christianity. They're also not required to cover things like pre-existing conditions in a lot of cases, and they can charge higher premiums for people that are more at risk. And the biggest thing, though, I think that people don't realize, especially when they're signing up, is that there's no guaranteed paying out of the medical claims that they're going to have under this, even with all those exclusions.
So
these are really predatory systems that prey on the credulous.
How many people?
Prayerful.
How many people are signed up for it? Do you know?
Millions. I don't know the exact number. I think it's about 1.5 million, but I'm not positive.
Yeah.
So just to go back to what they don't do, I imagine that each healthcare ministry, each healthcare sharing ministry is a little bit different from each other, so that you can't generalize completely, but you're saying that they do not have to provide essential health benefits like maternal health care, prescription drugs, mental, behavioral health, preventive and wellness services, and even vaccinations, which, of course, probably a lot of their people who buy into this are anti-vaxxers. But still, what do they do?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely correct. They get to pick and choose what they provide in the terms of their coverage, and then they get to pick and choose what they cover when people apply to have those costs covered after they've received the services. And so you can imagine what they end up doing is to make as much profit as possible, denying as many claims as possible, excluding as many things as possible. I mean, it really is, again, it's predatory and it's deceptive.
They also have...
It's really thrilling that Congress has stepped in and to do something about it.
They also have morality clauses, basically, right? Like if you're a smoker or you're obese, bad on you.
Yep.
Huh. So it's tough that you got lung cancer or you have diabetes, but we may not cover you. Is that right?
Yep, it's another way to pull all kinds of money in and then close off those claims when they happen. The Opening Arguments podcast, Andrew Torres, who's an attorney, did a really fantastic job explaining some of those ins and outs as well, and helped brief some members of the Congressional Freethought Caucus on these problems.
So briefly, Andrew, we just have 30 seconds. What is the caucus asking the Bureau to do?
Well, it's asking the FTC how it could protect consumers that are stuck in these systems and what it might have done to investigate past abuses or might do to investigate future abuses. Essentially, it's saying, hey, your job is to protect consumers, and healthcare sharing ministries are incredibly predatory. What are you going to do about it? How are you going to protect consumers? And they ask five specific questions with a number of sub-questions. We're really excited to see what comes of this investigation.
Well, thank you so much for your role in this and for joining us, Andrew Seidel, and we'll keep people posted.
Andrew Seidel is the Director of Strategic Response at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. So we're going to take another break, and after the break, stay tuned for Bart Warden. He's the Executive Director of the American Ethical Union. He will tell us about the many ethical society congregations around the country who are religious without God. I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
Hi, I'm Julia Sweeney, and I'm an atheist and former Catholic. I even wrote a play about it called Letting Go of God. Right now, Catholic bishops are using their considerable influence to deny women contraceptive rights. Please join the Freedom From Religion Foundation and help keep church and state separate. You can call 1-800-335-4021, that's 1-800-335-4021, or visit ffrf.org to stand up for true religious freedom.
So many gods, so many creeds, so many paths that wind and wind, when just the art of being kind is all this sad world needs.
Welcome back to Free Thought Radio. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and those are the words of the poet Ella Wheeler Wilcox, whose birthday we celebrate tomorrow. And that was, of course, music. Dan Barker set her poem, The World's Need, to music. Ella Wilcox was born November 5th, 1850.
And I'm Dan Barker. Welcome back. The poem she wrote says, just the art of being kind is all this sad world needs. Not the Bible, not God, just human kindness. Is it possible to be religious if you don't believe in God? There are many who think it is. Some of the groups in the Secular Coalition for America, of which FFRF is a member, are non-theistic religious organizations. They include the Society for Humanistic Judaism, the Cultural and Secular Jewish Organization, and the Unitarian Universalist Humanist Association.
Another non-theistic religious group in the secular coalition is the American Ethical Union, a national federation of ethical culture and ethical humanist societies. Founded in 1876, ethical societies are congregational, non-theistic, religious humanist fellowships that meet regularly to foster ethical relationships between individuals and groups. Ethical societies are actively engaged in social justice activities, such as civil and human rights, and protecting the secular nature of government.
The executive director for the American Ethical Union is Bart Warden. He's also a clergy leader for the Ethical Culture Society of Westchester in White Plains, New York. Bart has worked in community behavioral health as a direct care provider, as a program developer, and as an administrator. His recent social justice efforts focus on bias and discrimination. Bart Warden is a member of the Westchester Coalition for Police Reform and the 400 Years Project. We'll have to ask him what that is. It's a countywide coalition. He has a bachelor's in philosophy of religion from Hope College, a master's in social work from New York University, and is a graduate of the Humanist Studies program. We're happy to have Bart Warden on the phone with us today. Thanks for joining us today, Bart.
Happy to be here, Dan. Thank you.
Where are we talking to you from?
I am currently in Ossining, New York, a little bit north of New York City. People often know the town by its former name, Sing Sing, because the famous prison is just about 4 miles away from my house.
So the
operation.
The American Ethical Union was founded, I guess, on the centennial, right, 1876?
So the first ethical society was 1876. The union itself is, there were four societies by the time the union was formed, and that was in 1889. So that was New York and Philadelphia, Chicago, and St. Louis. Those four societies were already in existence at that point, and they came together to form the American Ethical Union.
So who started it?
Well, there was a whole bunch of people that actually started it, but the person who's credited with really coming up with the idea is a fellow named Felix Adler.
Yeah.
And he was the son of a Reformed Jewish rabbi who had been studying for the rabbinate himself, but had a real change of perspective in the course of his studies, and really came away thinking that really what was needed in the world was not a particular religion, but a way of people coming together to promote ethical living on a broader scale, you know, where anyone, I think what was the exact term used, we come together with a diversity of beliefs, but a unanimity of deeds. The real point that he was trying to make was if we can find ways for people to work together toward good, common good ends, we can kind of not get all bothered by what people's beliefs are. They can believe what they will, but let's see if we can work together.
So is the American Ethical Union, well, the American Ethical Union is not a church then?
It's so the union is actually a federation of societies. So ethical societies, there's now 23 of them, kind of sprinkled across the country, are congregational groups that would be, I guess under some law, would be considered a church, but we don't consider ourselves churches, but I think some legal entities look at it that way, but basically organized as congregations in the United States.
So it's not really quite like the Unitarian Universalists then, which definitely is a church, even though it's creedless.
Or a fellowship, they call it, don't they?
Sometimes, they call themselves societies, fellowships, but still they're under the church umbrella.
The Unitarian community does kind of straddle similar places. We like to think of ourselves as first cousins in many respects, in that they're also non-creedal. They're also, some of their groups do not call themselves churches. Some will call societies. Some will call communities and other different names. But the main thing is that they still have their religious they're organized as religion under the tax code and under the law, basically, which is also true for ethical societies.
But so ethical societies, do they meet weekly on Sundays, for example?
Most do. Most meet on Sundays. Some meet at other days of the week, and some meet not every Sunday. But the most common thing is for societies to gather on Sunday mornings.
And we certainly, we've been to some. We've been invited to speak, Chicago, Brooklyn. Dan, you were at the Manhattan.
Yeah,
right?
the one up on the Upper West Side.
Lots of wonderful people, and many of them also members of the Freedom from Religion Foundation when we've happened to be there. And tell us more about why there needs to be an American Ethical Union and what you stand for.
Sure. Well, again, we really stand for finding ways to help people come together for common good. We have very simple beliefs, right? So the main core belief we have is that it's possible that people can actually behave in ways that promote goodness in the world around them, right? And the other belief is that if people do that, chances are that things will get better than they currently are, right? So we're more of an inspirational and aspirational community. So what we really are hoping for is a really broad collection of people being part of our communities, because it's not for us what a person actually believes, but what a person believes they can do that is most important to us. And we think there's really lots of room for people to work together on that front.
So the American Ethical Union webpage says, and I'm quoting, "As a non-theistic organization, we do not concern ourselves with the existence or non-existence of a deity, but instead embrace the diversity of our membership." So that seems like a very, very good way to conduct your business.
It is. We wish it was actually translating into a stronger demographic diversity than we're currently realizing, but certainly aspirationally, that's right on.
So everything we've just talked about now, which is wonderful, can you call that religion? Does that fall under what you would call religion?
Well, first of all, you should know that if you were to just ask everyone in the American Ethical Union, do you consider ethical culture your religion? Some would say yes, and some would say no, and it might be pretty close to even split. So we don't require that people look at it as a religion, but we do organize as religion. For me, I look at it in terms of kind of what I imagine the root of religion is, which is ligare, which is L-I-G-A-R-E in the Latin, and that is related to ligament, and really speaks to the tying and binding quality that organizations can have when they're focused around a common name, right? And so in that sense, I think we do look at ourselves as religious. You know, the R-E before ligare is really just an intensifier anyway. And so if you imagine this is something that we feel really, really helps us pull together, make strong bonds together, make strong commitments to a better future, those sorts of things. I think you could imagine that you can have a religious quality about that. In other words, it's deep, meaningful, close to the core of what we stand for.
It's kind of like that old hymn, "Blessed be the tie that binds," whatever that tie is that, binds, that binds us as human beings in a common cause and in a common purpose. So what about you? Were you raised non-religious or religious or what?
Well, I was raised in a Reformed church, which comes out of the Dutch Reformed tradition, but my particular congregation was a very liberal one. The minister was a devotee of the positive thinking community, and that was not uncommon within the fold of that group. But I have to say, I had a very pleasant experience with the church, not so much around the belief end, but just in terms of the community. We enjoyed singing songs together and doing work projects together and having nice, deep, long conversations about all different kinds of things. And I at one point was actually aiming to become clergy myself and was looking to go to seminary. And it was only in college that I kind of had this awakening of atheism that made that like a not great idea. Though I'm sure I could have gotten into seminary, since a lot of people that are in there are atheists. But anyway, so I didn't find ethical culture until my wife, current wife, when we were dating, invited me to an ethical society for the first time.
Well, when we come back, we are talking with Bart Worden of the American Ethical Union. We're going to talk a little bit more about what happens there, and also I'm very intrigued about this 400-year project. Hmm. I'm Annie Laurie Gaylord.
I'm Dan Barker. We'll be back with more Free Thought Radio.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylord.
And I'm Dan Barker. Annie Laurie and I are co-presidents of the Freedom From Religion Foundation. We're continuing our interview with Bart Worden. He's the executive director of the American Ethical Union. And Bart, how can people reach you? You have a website?
Yes, we certainly do. It is AEU.org.
Wow, nice and simple. AEU.org.
For American Ethical Union.
That is correct.
You mentioned earlier, Bart, your desire or your plans to increase diversity and equity within the AEU. What are you doing about that?
Well, so the first thing was really doing a lot of work around trying to understand how we were preventing it from happening. And, you know, it's difficult often for people who imagine themselves working for the good to see how they might inadvertently often be kind of helping to undo the very things they're looking to do. So we're trying to be a bit more focused on undoing racism in particular as a heavy-duty lift for us. You know, we live in a culture that is has many systems in play to kind of keep the status quo as it is, and in particular to kind of maintain a sense of dominance of the European culture that came into this country hundreds of years ago. And, you know, it's a painful and kind of time-taking and worrisome process to go forward with. However, I do feel like we've made some good headway in terms of at least finding ways for our societies to engage more with their community around them, a broader community around them, and also for us to develop more educational opportunities for people to kind of get on board with what they can do to make things go better. So one of the local opportunities I've been involved with is the 400-year project in Westchester County, New York. And this is a project that recognizes 400 years of enslavement, or 400 years since the folks were first enslaved in the area that's now Virginia, and is an effort to kind of pull the more positive stories of people who survived depression and found ways to kind of make their way, and to see how the threads of those experiences continue today in the lives of people that are currently around. And it's giving us an opportunity to bring broad communities of people together in one space to really have a strong, positive, and reflective experience. And these are the kind of things I think we just need to do a lot more of. But in the end, yeah, we still have a lot of segregation. We still have a lot of injustice in terms of the policing and economic injustice, difficulties with healthcare. I mean, you name it. There are just so many huge areas, so we have a lot to do.
Is American Ethical Union, does it take a position on things, for example, reparations for slavery?
Certainly, yeah. We actually do have resolutions that you can find on our website on reparations in particular. And we are in favor of figuring out ways to repair the damage that's been done.
We have an article coming out, The Secular Case for Reparations, in probably the December issue of our newspaper, Free Thought Today. So we'll definitely go to your website and look that up, because I think that is a terribly long overdue issue. Of course, it also begs the question of what about the Native Americans? What about...
Well, they're all gone, you know, except for a few of us.
Oh, not at all. So that's another focus that we are continuing. It's been more difficult to address the Native populations just because they are so separated in many ways, both culturally and physically, and economically. And so it's been a bit harder to organize in that area than it has actually working with Black and other people of color. But it is there are still considerable issues going on, even locally. Long Island, I know, just had a big blow up with a group that is suffering from all the folks that tried to leave the city for COVID and are now polluting the waters around them so they can't fish anymore. I mean, there's all different places where people are suffering, and finding ways to get in there is really helpful.
And we should point out, I think, on this show at least, that historically the Atlantic slave trade and the genocide of Native Americans was very often biblically based. It was religion that was behind a lot of that system in the first place. Do you point that out in your AEU?
We actually are more focused on the economics of it. I mean, yeah, we do see how, you know, people utilize beliefs to kind of get people basically to justify actions. It seems to me that the economic factors were probably the stronger piece there. And that there was just a lot of thought that went into how can you find a way to enslave people that will be effective in turning them into machines.
Well, and of course,
we did a good job there.
Well, even though we can blame religion, slavery was in the U.S. Constitution, which is very grotesque. So
yeah.
It was a piece of enlightenment that was. Not enlightened at all. I mean, to understate the problem. So it is a nationwide governmental issue as well. It's not, although we can blame a lot on religion, it's not something that is confined to religion. So does AEU also take positions on things like abortion rights?
We're very especially protective of the women's right to choose. And so that is something we've had as resolutions for going back quite a long while. In fact, I believe the first public meeting to discuss legalized abortion was held at the Westchester Ethical Society, where I'm currently the leader.
Really?
In 1964, I think.
Yeah, well, the early 60s were when everything started moving with abortion rights, the Sherry Finkbein case and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Bart, how many people have you, and I'm not sure if you can answer this question, but how many people belong to congregations that are part of the American Ethical Union?
Right now, around 2,000, I think, we have in our 23 societies.
Wow.
So do you know, was it...
We have people outside of that are, you know, members and friends, and also we have people that are now joining via the Internet now that we're meeting so much online. So it's, but in terms of the brick and mortar societies and their actual formal memberships, about 2,000.
So if I show up on a Sunday or whenever you have your meeting, what will I see? Will there be choir singing, or what happens at a typical meeting?
It varies from society to society. A lot of our societies do incorporate music. Some incorporate community singing. Almost all of them incorporate presentations that would be around the question, how are we to live? And trying to figure out responses to that question. And most of our societies also have a fair amount of participation from the congregation in the meetings on Sundays as well.
And since you are a member of the Secular Coalition, it's obvious then that AAU is very much in favor of keeping religion and government separate, right?
Yes, we're strongly in favor of the separation of religious organizations and the government, for sure.
In terms of the history with Felix Adler, are there books that he wrote? Are there books about the American Ethical Union that people can read? Do you publish
Certainly.
Books?
Certainly. Yep. A book that he wrote, is a bit tough to get through, is An Ethical Philosophy of Life. An easier book to read would be The Humanist Way by Ed Erickson. That was done, I think, in the early 70s and is a very readable and very helpful book in terms of gathering the core ideas that drive our society.
Well, thank you, Bart. We're out of time. Bart Warden is the executive director of the American Ethical Union, AEU.org. Thank you for being with us today.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners in Philadelphia to WOOM, listeners in Madison, Wisconsin to WMUU and WIDE, in Janesville, Wisconsin, WADR, KEOS in Bryan, Texas, KOPN in Columbia, Missouri, KEPW in Eugene, Oregon, KZSM in San Marcos, Texas, WOOL, Black Sheep Radio in Vermont, New Hampshire, WRFI in Ithaca, New York. And hello to all you many thousands of podcast listeners. Please give us a thumbs up on your podcast provider and tell your friends and family to find out more about Freethought Radio at ffrf.org/radio.
You can ask for more information about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. You can ask for a sample of our November issue with those fabulous essays by the Students of Color winners of our essay contest. You can join us and support our vital work to keep religion and government separate and promote reason and science in our laws and our policies. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Freethought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday